You're listening to Object of Sound from Sonos, the show where we bring you in tune with the music that shapes our culture. When music lives in the air, it's one thing. But when you know the undercurrents and the ideas that went into a song, when you can feel its weight, it becomes more meaningful. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib, a poet and culture critic, and I'll be your guide as we seek a deeper way of listening. The first time I heard Biz Markie was in my brother's car when I was maybe 6 or 7 years old. He'd gotten his first car and had a tape deck in it, and my brother was a collector of tapes, hip-hop tapes especially. And one tape he played a lot was the first Biz Markie album, Going Off. And there was a song on that album that he especially loved to play called I'll Be Square Mall. I remember loving because of its infectious chorus, because of how magnetic it felt. And I remember kind of feeling like this was a song that even back then I understood to not be overwhelmingly serious, but to be a song about a place that meant a great deal to someone. And I really loved and admired that.
On the mic at this time, in the place to be, I'm the inhuman orchestra called Biz Markie. They made the man to make the music with my mouth and all, but I'm here to talk about the Irish Square Mall, a place where people shop.
And I remember going through the liner notes of these Biz Markie albums and looking at the covers for The Biz Never Sleeps, for example, his second album, and being in awe of this person who seemed to hold a massive and intense personality. And it felt that was a song that made up a cluster of songs that were my introduction to hip-hop music, to hip-hop culture, my introduction to rhymers and beatboxers and DJs and people who dug in the crates for samples. Biz Markie was among the artists who invited me in and built a world for me to feel at home within the genre that I came to love a great deal. You've likely heard by now that the great Biz Markie, legend, DJ, beatboxer, rapper, sampler, collector, and member of the legendary Juice Crew, passed away last week at the age of 57. And so this week on Object of Sound, I wanted to have a special episode in memory of Biz Markie, who became widely known as the artist behind the song Just a Friend.
Have you ever met a girl that you tried to date, but a year to make love, she wanted you to wait? Let me tell you a story.
But who leaves behind a much richer and more robust legacy in hip-hop music, not just as a rapper, but as an innovator, as someone who pushed the boundaries of music videos and visuals and persona. To remember Biz Markie, his life in all its fullness, I've invited my pals Dart Adams and DJ Lene Denise onto the show. Dart Adams is a music historian, journalist, lecturer, and author. He's known for his blogs, Poisonous Paragraphs, Blogger House, Bastard Swordsman, and Producers I Know. Lene Denise is a DJ, scholar, and writer who explores underground cultural movements and electronic music of the African diaspora. And at the end of this episode, I'll walk you through a playlist of Biz Markie album cuts, maybe some lesser-known songs that folks don't know as well, but hopefully can get to know well through the playlist. You can hear that playlist on mixcloud.com/Sonos, and we'll leave a link to it in the show notes. Lene and Dart, thank y'all so much for joining me to talk about Biz for a little bit. When I wanted to do a tribute episode, I figured it would be vital to get some historical context alongside the emotional context that kind of floods the internet after we lose a legend. So thank y'all for offering that.
No problems. What I'm here for.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm wondering if y'all could tell me, you know, I was thinking about the first Biz Markie song that I heard, and it was I'll Be Square Mall alongside of We Write the Songs, in part because my eldest brother really loved those two. I mean, he loved In Control Volume 1 when it came out, and he loved that first Biz record when it came out. Those were my first memories of Biz Markie. But I'm wondering, Lene, first, if you could tell me the first time you heard Biz.
It was 1988, and it was The Vapors.
Can you feel it? Can you feel it?
motherfucking savior. But this is the season of catching the vapors. And since I got time, what I'm going to do is tell you how they spread it.
I also had an older sister in California, but we grew up on East Coast rap. So she was listening to a lot of EPMD and Erykah and Rakim, but vapors landed in LA in this incredible way because it made so much sense in terms of deep bass and car culture, right? So really my first introduction to it was like hearing the vapors come out of 1964 Impalas and El Caminos and even Nissan Sentras on Crenshaw on Sunday nights, right? That's almost like a place where new music in LA was premiered, was through that kind of car culture Sunday night strip. And so musically, that was just my jam. And then the stories that I felt proud to memorize, the stories that define the word that he introduced to us as a way to say, you know, like, I remember when at first you wasn't. Now guess what they caught from my cousin. We had a new language to describe folks who slept on us.
Dart, when was the first time you heard or heard of Biz?
So in Boston, a big part of hip hop culture was beatboxing. There was a guy named A-Train, aka Cub Lunk, who was a world renowned beatboxer. And he was like the elite guy out of Boston. He used to battle everybody from New York, Philly, Connecticut, going just up, right? And back in 1985, he battled this kid called the Inhuman Orchestra, Biz Markie. Mm-hmm. And came back to Boston telling stories about how crazy this dude was. And not too long after that, there was a song that came out by Roxanne Shanté on Pop Art out of Philly called Def Fresh Crew with Biz Markie on beatbox. And this was the first time I heard for myself Biz Markie. And then later he made a song called Nobody Beats the Biz.
Nobody beats the Biz.
Nobody beats the Biz.
Which came along with this phenomenon called the Biz Dance.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And this is like 86 going into 87, and it was over from there.
I wanted to kind of hit on the Juice Crew because I don't know if folks understand the depth of talent that was kind of present there, you know, helmed primarily by the production of Marley Marl, but there was also Kane and Roxanne Shanté and Kool G Rap and Master Ace and Intelligent Hoodlum, later Tragedy Gaddafi, Mr. Magic, and so on and so on and so on. And I thought it would be an important moment to kind of uplift the vitality of the Juice Crew, who have a legacy that I think is firmly situated in the legacy of Biz Markie, but also expands beyond it.
Yeah, I think one of the huge issues regarding Biz Markie standing in the Juice Crew is that when people think Juice Crew, they typically centralize their thoughts upon, you know, Big Daddy Kane. Then they think about Kool G Rap. Then they think about like a Master Ace, a Craig G, or like sometimes Roxanne Shanté. The people typically don't start with Biz Markie, but Biz was the entertainer. The person who put asses in the seats, who entertained the crowd, made people really go crazy and kept the party going was Biz. Biz was a multi-talented guy. He was the beatboxer. He was an MC. He was an entertainer. He was a DJ. He was a producer in his own right. But, you know, the reason why people don't think of Biz the way they do is because largely he had a writer a lot of the times. He's the guy who actually put on Big Daddy Kane by saying, all right, Kane, you running with me. So you're going to write rhymes for me on my first album, Going Off. They would do routines and stuff together. So Big Daddy Kane's career was actually attributed to the fact that he was running with Biz. That's how he got his foot in the door. He would roll up to the Juice Crew, be like, yeah, I'm Biz's guy. I'm the dude that wrote, you know, Pick and Boogie.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I'm the dude that wrote Vapors. And they're like, oh, sure, come in. People don't realize that. Or think about the fact that the Juice Crew is always thought about as like the MCs, the lyricists, the dudes that went back to back on the symphony, as opposed to the fact that like Biz set a lot of these guys up. Like the popularity of the Juice Crew was because Biz was the guy. Like Biz could rock a crowd without actually rapping. He didn't have to say a single verse, and people would leave like they didn't feel shortchanged. If Kane went on stage and didn't do verses, people would be like, what the hell do we come for? That's the beauty of Biz Markie and the Juice Crew dynamic.
You know, I saw Biz Markie live, you know, in the 2000s at some point, and he was still very beholden to that idea of my presence is first and foremost to move the crowd and to keep the crowd engaged. Even though he was headlining the show, he was still giving up for his DJ. He would still give his DJ a ton of space to operate. And he was almost just like a vessel for the DJ. And there's a real generosity in that. Not saying that he was a secondary artist, but he allowed himself the flexibility to be multiple things on a stage.
That's why he was the quintessential artist or MC slash whatever you needed. He was everything. He understood what it meant, the role of being a DJ. So he gave the DJ their space. He was a great duo with him and his cousin, DJ Kool V. He also was a great DJ himself. He understood breaks and records. So he worked well with Molly Mall. And also when he broke out on his own, a lot of people do not discuss this. You know, we like to talk about going off, but the diabolical Biz Markie, yes. The Biz Never Sleeps. The work he did when he finally got his like own production label up and produced his brother Diamond Shell, whose album came out 30 years ago. Like all the work he did with other people, his mentoring of producers, MCs, and DJs, his fingerprints are all over the culture. Whether we're talking about like being a collector, where we're talking about digging for breaks, where we're talking about appreciation of music. I mean, when you think about great entertainers in hip hop, the first two names I think of are Dougie Fresh and Biz Markie. Those are guys that could rock the show without necessarily rapping a verse. Think about the fact that kids know him from Yo Gabba Gabba.
Here's Biz's beat of the day.
Or they know him from a Men in Black movie. Or they remember his run on In Living Color when it was over. A lot of people forget mm-hmm. that. The man was on In Living Color during his final run, his final episodes, along with people like Chris Rock. So he was all over the place. And he was much more than a popular single, just a friend. Right.
It was important for me to remember that he was born in 1964. He was born when Malcolm and Martin were still alive. And he was born in Harlem. But I think like, you know, you talk about him as a Renaissance man and this human orchestra. And I think it's interesting because I knew and I tried to avoid, in fact, some of the kind of stories and responses that came out following his death, because I knew that the emphasis was going to be placed on him as clown.
Yes.
And I think in that context, we can be distracted from his skill and his level of mastery around several aspects of hip hop culture, DJ, beatboxer, producer, host, actor, facilitator, curator, dancer. And so I just wanted to push back on that clown print narrative.
Absolutely. It bothered me to see like headlines that after his death, yes. like referring to him as clown prince, because I think humor or relying on a narrative in which Biz Markie was only funny really flattens what I think he was delving into persona. I remember the video for Spring Again so vividly where like he is two different people. He's singing the chorus in like a giant wig, but he's taking it seriously. He took his forays into persona seriously, even though they were playful pursuits. But I think there's a difference between a type of rigorous and thoughtfully curated playfulness and what he gets flattened to. Like, well, he was a clown, which he wasn't a clown.
Mm-mm. Not one bit.
I feel that what happens is that we had people from outside the culture who were seeing it, and that was their perception of what Biz Markie represented, because they start with you got what I
right.
need, and the
right.
video is
right.
their point of reference. They don't think of Biz Markie as like a serious artist that people take seriously and have by the time that song came out 4 or 5 years. You know, so to them, that was their introduction to him. And I think a lot of people got it twisted that they thought that he was trying to make another Just a Friend for the rest of his career when he was just really doing what he did. Like Spring Again was not an attempt to have another crossover hit.
Spring Again. Everybody knows Spring Again.
Let Me Turn You On wasn't an attempt to make another Just a Friend.
No way.
And I think that a lot of people who just started picking up his albums afterwards kind of thought that. Like, they thought Toilet Stool Rap was, you know, a failed attempt at having, like, a crossover song. And I'm like, no. He was being himself. Like, his first single that a lot of people remember was yes. Pickin' Boogers.
But it's still something we all have to do. To go up your nose with a finger or two and pull out one all crusty crew. Yo.
It's like, yes, it's humorous, but a lot of people made humorous songs. I mean, Kool G Rap would infuse humor in some of the most gangster songs you could think about, you know? Mm-hmm. But that's just what you had to do. Big Daddy Kane did the same. So when you try to frame Biz Markie as he was like the clown prince of hip hop, like that just shows you don't fully understand the subject matter or the artist that you're covering or you're speaking about.
Precisely, yeah. I never thought of this. And I think that, sadly, I'm thinking about it solely because both of them are gone. But I realize for me that there is an important artistic resemblance between MF Doom and Biz Markie, just in terms of being sort of like playfully brilliant and playfully serious, I think with like encyclopedic knowledge about popular culture that comes through the sonic references, the lyrical references, but they were both, and in Biz Markie's case, with the help of a ghostwriter, but sort of world building around their persona. I thought that there was an important line to be drawn between those two MC producer type cats that used humor as an anchor, but humor that when we are talking about it being expressed through Black people tends to be divorced from intelligence, right? I'm talking about their impeccable timing. Their comedic timing is key to me.
Yes. But I also think, like, well beyond Just a Friend, the Biz Markie chorus, even if he wasn't the one performing the chorus, the songs that he was on had choruses like the Albee Square Mall chorus, even though I know it's not him, it's like so deeply embedded in my brain. You know what I mean? Like, Nobody Beats the Biz, Spring Again. I feel like there's something that does a disservice to his musical ability as a vessel for other people's writing, which I think is somewhat difficult to be sometimes, or even as a canvas for other people to shine, which I think that he did so generously and richly in a lot of his albums.
You know, Jazzy Jeff did a tribute the day after Biz passed. And what came up for me, obviously, you know, the world of samples around him, who he sampled, who sampled him, being sued and having that landmark case that changed how hip hop could engage sampling and then releasing All Samples Cleared. But at the core of what we mean by sampling is digging through the crates. That is what he was doing. He was a collector and he was an archivist, right? Mm-hmm. And he actually, you know, I was thinking about the fact that he does to the sample, like what Aretha does to the cover, you know, like makes you forget the original. I am not thinking about Papa Don't Take No Mess. I'm thinking about The Vapors. When I listen to James Brown, I'm thinking of Biz Markie. That relationship with sampling was critical. That's a major moment in hip hop. His life, his contribution to the art form represents like that shift in the culture, which is unpacked in detail in that documentary film. What is it called? Copyright Criminals, right? When they talk about Biz's role in that too.
I mean, when you think about what hip hop did at its core, what rap music did at its core, it took music that didn't matter how long ago it came out, that people had pretty much maybe forgotten about or hadn't revisited in a long time, and took it and recontextualized it and brought it back again. You know, you listen to AZ's Gimme Yours, you have Nas singing Eye Levels Give Me. which was a black radio staple between 1982 and 1983. But when it came out 12 years later, there were two full generations of listeners who had no idea what the song was. They thought Nas came up with that on the spot, you know? And I say that because what Bismarck Key did with Alone Again Naturally, which actually got him sued by Gilbert O'Sullivan. Think about the generations of people that heard Alone Again Naturally who never heard the original song.
I'm not feeling any less sad. I promised myself to treat myself and visit a nearby town.
I was on my way to 125th. I saw this death bench, yo, that's my man Cliff. As I flagged him down, he pulled to the side. At this moment, I had to swallow my pride.
Think about Let Me Turn You On. How many people, like, maybe heard Ain't No Stopping Us in passing, or, you know, had been to the cookout and, like, that's their parents' music, you know? And Biz Markie recontextualizes it and turns it into something else.
Say, well, there ain't no way to stop me now. Come on, let me hear you say, well.
He brought up a bunch of records that reinvigorated it and made it applicable and, like, the word I'm looking for is, I hate using it, relevant to a whole new generation of music listeners. And it heightened music discovery. And people do not give Bismarck the credit for that. And I mean, yeah, the landmark case, we're approaching the 30th anniversary of it. It happened December 17th, I believe, 1991.
Yep.
Can you just break that case down for us a bit for people who don't know about it?
So basically what the case came down to was this Grand Upright Music, Warner Brothers versus Gilbert O'Sullivan. What actually happened is Warner Brothers, Cold Chillin', Bismarck is in the process of recording his album. They send something to Gilbert O'Sullivan saying that we're about to sample you. He pretty much is like, I'm good. No, thank you. They go through with it anyway. Put the song on the album, and Gilbert O'Sullivan's lawyers hit them immediately. Like, I actually declined. Like, I didn't want you to sample my music at all. This was what brought everything to a head. And what came of it is there were sample clearance laws that were put in place. Sample rights were made different, and these different statutes were lined up that everybody had to adhere to. And the big thing that happened was that in album liner notes and album credits, you had to attribute where you got your samples from. And again, this changed everything from rap from 1992 on. So that Bismarck case loomed large in hip hop.
One last thing I want to touch on is there was a photo of Chuck D holding up all the names of hip-hop legends who have passed in recent months. And I think to see it presented in that way was really stark for me. I am someone who still believes pretty firmly that hip-hop is young. And yet, it does feel to me that we are losing a lot of folks. You know, I was really heartbroken by losing Gifted Gab. And I was heartbroken to lose Shock G, who I think people treated like a clown when he was just like, had a depth of knowledge about funk, about soul, about blues. What I'm mostly getting at is I'm wondering if y'all had any thoughts on the rapid amount of loss that we've seen in hip hop since December. From December to now, it feels like we've lost a lot of folks in particular.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I turned 46 in weeks, and I had to start taking things seriously when first Pumpkinhead, known as PH, passed away, followed shortly by Sean Price. And both of those hit me hard because those are guys I remember. I'd go and I'd see, like, they're my age. They're in my age group, you know? And, like, Doom passing, that was crushing. Malik B passing, crushing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having Gift the Gab pass after Double K. Yeah. Oh, that was a gut punch, both of them, back to back. But Bismarck's passing left me dazed. You know, I needed a standing eight after that one because of what this man represented to so many people. And it was just insane to me thinking about how large biz looms in the culture. You can't talk to somebody who's prominent in hip hop and they don't have Biz Markie stories. Him calling them, him giving them advice, him being there. Biz Markie was there when LL Cool J wrote one of his classic verses. He was there. Biz Markie beatboxed for Kid Wizard Rakim at Wyandanch High School in 1985. Biz Markie has been everywhere. He was the beatbox for Real Roxanne after she fell out with Marley Marl and toured with her.
I just want to kind of jump in the 80s because the question makes me think about the number of Black women fiction writers who were dying prematurely in the 80s and the 90s. And cancer being like the number one culprit in that death, which is to say stress and the taxes that come with Black life. But I was just thinking that our rappers are not protected from, you know, what Sadia Hartman describes as like the afterlife of slavery, which includes addiction, you know, and thinking about Shock G, Prince, DMX, and premature death and health-related issues in terms of diabetes and sickle cell and Fife and Dilla and Biz.
And Miss Melody.
And Black Rob and Miss Melody. Our rappers are not protected from that phenomenon of just like dying early.
Yeah.
There's so many. And it's sad that there are so many names.
I will say, to end on a slight uptick, whenever we lose folks, it is always both heartbreaking and a little uplifting for me to hear from not only my peers who I know have wonderful contributions to the culture, like you both, but also folks who were there, who have stories. I mean, Dart mentioned the thing about how Biz was everywhere. And there were so many people, LL being one of them, who like came out with stories where it's like, yo, I didn't know that. I had no idea. And I want to thank you both for coming here and adding to the archive in a way that is very fulfilling for me as well. Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Those were my friends, DJ Lene Denise and Dart Adams. I'm so thankful they could join us this week. Now for a final thought. I am someone who is a collector of great many things, of records, of cultural artifacts, old vintage magazines, and of course of sneakers. And Biz Markie and I shared some collection impulses. One of my favorite old videos of Biz Markie is kind of him walking a camera crew through his house and showing off his mini collections, sneakers that were still in boxes and piles of records and old DJ equipment.
I collect a lot of things, and some things I just like to be next to me. All old school cassettes. Is that a lot of what?
DJ Barbie.
I got jewelry for days. Crazy.
Come along with me into one of my sneaker rooms. As you can see, I am an avid sneaker collector. I'm just showing you a couple.
As I immerse myself in the search and collection of many items, I am understanding now, especially as I age, that I learned this impulse and this obsession from older hip-hop heads that I grew up around, like my oldest brother, who collected first tapes in these large old trunks, literal trunks, like the kind you would see on a Navy ship. And my older brother also collected shoes, but I would see older rappers like Biz Markie collecting records, collecting shoes, accumulating things as a way of both archival and curiosity. And I am drawn to collection as an impulse in the same way that those people were. Losing Biz Markie, I am not only losing someone who meant a great deal to me as a musician, but I'm losing someone who showed a path for me to feel no shame behind accumulating the many things I am obsessed with, and through that accumulation, furthering those obsessions and furthering those excitements.
This is the creme de la creme of my collection. Like I know what records I need if I need to go out and play.
If you are a collector or if you are someone who collects things, I hope that there are people in your life you appreciate, the people who showed you what it is to pursue the things you're passionate about and grab them when you can. And so I want to thank Biz Markie for that as well. You've been listening to Object of Sound from Sonos. big thank you to our guests this week, Dart Adams and DJ Lene Denise. Listen to Roxanne Gay talk with Alex Frank, host of the new show Sound Out, featured on Full Spectrum. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. If you like what you hear, go ahead and rate it and share it with your friends. This is a communal thing, music discovery. So tell us what you like about the show and what you're listening to. Let us know your thoughts in an email at objectofsound@sonos.com. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Sonos Radio. This show is produced by Work by Work, Scott Newman, Gemma Rose Brown, Babette Thomas, Mayari Sharina Ong, and by me, Hanif Abdurraqib. The show is mixed by Sam Baer. Extra gratitude to Joe Dawson and Saida Blount at Sonos. I'm always talking about music online on Instagram and Twitter at Neef Muhammad. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for being a part of the show.